One of the things that I noticed is how some words really have sort of entered this kind of meditative culture, and they're not always familiar. And first of all, how many people are here for the first time? Well, welcome. I would really urge you to find the literature that is around about programs that happen here, because what an incredible blessing to live in a place where there's a center and where there's there are ongoing programs in a community. And so the word dana, D-A-N-A, as Tiwari said, means generosity. It's a word from Pali, which is the language of the original Buddhist texts. And like at the Insight Meditation Society, which is a center I co-founded, which is going to celebrate its 40th anniversary next year. That's why I'm called senior, because I kind of am at this point. Very often people will come and we don't serve coffee, for example, so people will bring their own coffee. They'll bring their own, like, M&Ms or whatever. And then when they leave, they'll often leave those things for the next retreat. And so they'll usually leave it around with a sign that says, Dana, which means this is an offering, this is a gift. And I realize that sometimes we don't actually explain the word, because I have a friend who came to sit a retreat once, and she said to me, who's Dana, and why'd she leave all her stuff here, you know? Like tissues, coffee, M&Ms. Like. So, and if you hear me using a word you don't know what it means, call me on it, okay? Because it's a bugaboo of mine that I do that. So dana does mean generosity. I mean, we are here in this amazing place because of generosity and the generosity of the people who've created this organization. And so it's wonderful to think, as Tiwari just described, if this is the core of our being here together tonight. So what I'm actually talking about, I noticed, is compassion, which is a beautiful thing to be able to talk about. I guess I would say that there are two main provocative things about compassion that make it a little bit startling sometimes in this culture. One is we can so easily think of a quality, well, it's kind of like generosity too. We can think of these qualities as making us a little bit foolish or weak or lacking discernment. I've often said that I think we're in some ways conditioned to think of something like kindness, that whole range of qualities, as being sort of a secondary virtue. Like if you can't be brilliant and you can't be courageous and you can't be wonderful, it's like, okay, be kind, you know. It's like, it's nice. It's not great, but it's nice. But actually it is great. It is of greatness. I think if any of us look back in our lives at someone who was really kind to us, we don't think of that person with scorn, like I fooled them, you know? I mean, it's such a power to be met in that way. And so one of the things we usually need to do is really explore the strength, the power of these qualities, generosity, loving kindness, compassion, kindness. So that's the first thing, is finding the strength. The second thing, which is kind of controversial or provocative, is the idea that these qualities can be trained. And it does sound a little cold or mechanical to us. I know that. Like, I went to this retreat center for a non-residential weekend, and I got compassionate, you know, or I walked away with my certificate in compassion. Or it does sound weird, but it's really believed that these qualities of the heart are like emergent properties that are born of how we pay attention. Are we really there? Are we fragmented? Are we lost in self-preoccupation? Can we care? Do we include? Who do we leave out? Who doesn't count? Who doesn't matter? What happens when that range of who we pay attention to gets bigger? What happens when we break through our assumptions about somebody and we really see them in a different way? Those are all the questions that kind of frame the exploration, out of which we come to understand that we're not trying to manufacture these qualities or certainly not make believe that they're there when we're really seething inside, but that depending on how we pay attention, they will emerge, right? So, oh yes, someone's visiting. If you could turn off your cell phones, that'd be good. When we pay attention differently, we are laying the ground. We've created the conditions for something like compassion to emerge. And interestingly enough, given Tuer's beautiful talk, qualities like loving kindness and compassion are considered qualities of generosity. They may not be material generosity, although certainly they might be, but they are definitely generosity of the spirit. It's an offering. It's a giving. It's being different. Right? So here's one example. You know, we had a terrible, horrible, awful, dreadful winter in the East Coast. And there was one week when I had to go to D.C. by train from New York City on a Monday, because I had a class in D.C. Monday night. And then I had to come back up to New York City on Tuesday, because I had a class in New York Tuesday night. Plus, I had a whole bunch of appointments in the afternoon. So, of course, my train to D.C. got canceled, so that was a whole hassle. But I finally made it the day I needed to get there, and I taught my class. And the next morning on Tuesday, I got to the train station to see that my train was quite postponed. I finally got on the train, and we went just far enough to be in the middle of nowhere, and we stopped. And the conductor got on the PA system, and he said, well, the train ahead of us has broken down, and we'll just be moving soon. So we waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. In the meantime, canceling things for the afternoon, you know. And finally, we move. We make one stop, and then we go far enough to be in the middle of nowhere, and we break down. So the conductor gets on the PA system, and he said, you know, these things run like a cable car with a connection to these wires. He said, well, we hit a block of ice, which there was plenty of all winter. And he said, we broke apart. He said, it's such an unusual part to break. He said, I have never seen this before. And the good news is we have a spare part. The bad news is that it's so weird a thing that an inspector has to come to check out whether the repair was okay. So we waited and 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 waited. And finally the conductor says, we're not going anywhere. So we're going to pull a new train next to this one. And then I don't know if any of you have ever had that experience. They put down like these planks, you know, and you sort of walk from one train to the other. So we did that, and turns out that the new train was a local, right? So an endless period of time goes by, and what should have been a trip door to door that was 4 hours was over 8.5 hours, right? No food, no water, nothing. So I finally get to, I live in Barrie, but I have a sublet apartment in New York City. So I finally get to that building. I have an hour before my class starts. I'm exhausted, right? And I get into the elevator to go upstairs, and there's a woman in the elevator, a complete stranger. And she says to me, today is my birthday. And I thought, oh my God. You should hear about my day. It was miserable. And then I just looked at her and I got there. It was like, okay, it's her birthday. And I just said to her, that's terrific. I hope you have a great evening. And I got off of my stop. You know, I had a few minutes, went out and taught my class. But I thought it was an interesting moment, you know, because I had no data on her. I didn't know her. I didn't know if that was like the best moment of her day, talking to a total stranger in an elevator, or if she was going on to a fantastic party with many loved ones. But it sort of didn't matter, right? What mattered was that I could leave my self-preoccupation and my misery and my complaint about Amtrak and the government and everything and just be there with her. And it was actually a pure moment of delight in that connection. So how do we pay attention to one another? And can we relinquish the hold of the things we sort of define ourselves by and the way we grapple with reality? I have a friend who said something like, about 200 times today, I have an argument with reality. You know, shouldn't have happened, shouldn't be there, right? And it was actually a very beautiful moment. And I have another story, which is kind of similar to that, about attention. So I was teaching in Ireland this last May, and one of the retreatants told this story. He said that he and like three friends were traveling in the States, and at the end of that trip, they were going from California to Chicago to New York. Just that was their day of transition. And then in New York, they were going to catch their connecting flight to go back to Ireland. So there was some tremendous delay in Chicago. So he said by the time we got to New York, to the airport, it was after midnight. Our luggage was lost. Our connecting flight had left long before. And this woman came out to help us, an airline personnel. And he said, I took a look at her face and I decided she looked worse than we did. It's like after midnight, she's in the airport. And he said, I noticed from her name tag that her name was Irene. And then he said the cutest thing. He said, it seemed to me from looking at her that she had not been serenaded lately. And I told this story to a friend who said, well, that could be said for all of us, really, you know? Anyway, he said, I noticed, you know, she seemed like she had not been serenaded lately, and I happened to be traveling with a traveling banjo. So I pulled out my banjo, and I started singing, good night, Irene, good night. And he said, my three friends joined in, and then all these doors started opening and people started coming out to work for different airlines and they joined in and we had like this rousing serenade of Irene, at the end of which she said, I am the best person in this company at finding luggage. I am going to find your luggage and I'm going to take care of you. And I thought, what a great story. And it was so funny because like 5 days later, I was in France and my luggage got lost. And needless to say, I did not have a traveling banjo. But I did try to have some loving kindness for the woman who was trying to help me. And I just thought different elements of his story. He noticed her name. She looked worse than we did. She looked like she had not been serenaded in a while, right? But how are we usually? Here is the enemy, the representative of the company, which has like eaten my luggage on purpose. They kept me in Chicago just so I would miss this flight. That's how we usually feel. So can we shift how we pay attention? And instead of being so consumed with the sense of self and other and us and them, with a great big other out there, can we kind of go underneath that and feel the connection that is actually true? That we're all here together. We all have something to do with one another. Doesn't mean you like everybody. It actually doesn't even mean you like anybody. But that kind of sense of huge distance and separation and alienation, as though you have nothing to do with me, that's what dissolves as we pay attention differently. We look at each other, we listen to each other. We can leave that realm, that sort of hotbed of complete self-preoccupation, and genuinely have a sense of connection. So compassion in particular is said to be that quality of connection that is based on understanding the universality of our vulnerability, that whatever our lives look like, and they are different. It's not to imply that we all have the same measure of pain or suffering, because clearly we don't. But we do share the uncertainty of things, of conditions. Life's changing all of the time. We have this kind of vulnerability. So sometimes people think of compassion as a state that is kind of distant. Like I, who have this perfect life, which is so intact, am way over here. And I'm kind of bestowing this kindness on you way down there, you know, because your life has fallen apart, which mine never, ever, ever could. Well, guess what? It could. It does. So one of the first ingredients of compassion is the sense of connection that's not like superior, inferior. It's actually not hierarchical. It's really a sense of togetherness. Another thing about compassion is that it's not actually considered to be the same thing as being, as feeling broken, overwhelmed, burnt out, nearly destroyed by suffering that we see. We may go there, and very often we actually do, but it's not the same thing as compassion. And if we realize that, and the debilitation or the devastation of that state, we work to come back. So compassion is defined as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. And this is in contrast to a movement into, to burn up. It's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. There's some sense of energy, sufficiency, caring, and balance that is actually inherent to this quality of compassion. And it's not easy. It's not even easy to understand. And so we continue to explore it. The trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering, it's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. Our hearts are actually moved in some way, this tremendous poignancy in this life. And we realize that if we are devastated, overwhelmed, exhausted, depleted, that there's not like the wherewithal within us to really move toward, to see if we can be of help, right? We're just like, okay. One way this is actually talked about these days, interestingly enough, is a distinction that can be made and is made in terms of research between empathy and compassion. Empathy being a necessary but not sufficient condition for compassion to arise. So empathy, of course, can be cognitive empathy. It's just a kind of sensing intellectually, well, that must hurt. Or it can be more a resonance within us. It's a kind of almost vibration, like, ooh. Not an imposition, not like, I know exactly what you're feeling, but we can have a sense of, ooh, I know you are likely to feel overlooked, abandoned, unseen, because I was in some situation where that came up for me. Right? So it's so likely that you're struggling in these ways. But it said that empathy can lead to what is called empathic distress. And rather than having the energy, right, to come toward, to see if we can be of help. And that's a sort of ironic state, because then our own distress, our own bad feeling, kind of takes center stage. And it said in the research that the main reason people have empathy, which is good, we have to have empathy, right? Otherwise we're completely alienated from one another. So it's not that empathy in any way is bad, but it may not be enough. It may be incomplete. So one of the ways that empathy can lead to distress is if we over-identify. It's not like I am really feeling within me what it is likely happening for you. It's like, that is me, right? And then we're lost, because it's just too overwhelming. But the way I usually describe it is something that's sequential. We have this genuine moment of empathy, perhaps, which we need to have, but maybe, you know, sensing someone is likely really struggling, we feel exhausted, we feel depleted, we think, I can't deal. Or we feel frightened and we want to go away. Or we feel blaming. I gave you perfectly good advice 6 months ago. If you'd only listened to it, you wouldn't be in this condition, right? Or we get into that strange kind of egotistical thing like, I'm going to fix you by Thursday. All you need to do is this. Or we can have the compassionate response. So compassion is one of the many possible responses we can have subsequent to the genuine moment of empathy. And I find it so interesting, partly because I just seem to do quite a lot of work with caregivers, people who are either professionally or personally in some service role to others. And there's such a big national movement now for increasing empathy. And I always say in these conferences and stuff, I say, but what about the burnt out people? They have lots of empathy. You know, they need something else. We need something else, which is more about being able to know the difference between empathy and compassion and looking at what it means to develop compassion. It means balance. Compassion for ourselves as well as for others. It means being able to connect to something bigger. I once went to Walter Reed Army Hospital to teach. It was a while ago. It was the old hospital before they moved. And I went because it was like National or International Nurses Week, and they had all these programs for the nurses. So obviously it was the meditation program. And a friend of mine was a nurse there, and she had arranged the talk, and she arranged for me to have a tour before the talk of a little part of one of the wards. And needless to say, it was extremely intense between the soldiers and their families. It was very, very intense. And so he did the tour, and then my friend, the nurse, turned to me at the end, and she said to me, the nurses who can stay here, and that, of course, means the people who can continue to serve here, the nurses who can stay here are not the ones who get lost in sorrow. The nurses who can stay here are the ones who can connect to the resilience of the human spirit. And right there, I thought, that's compassion. Right? Being able to connect to something bigger. Because if we go down with the ship, no one gets helped. Right? We need to be able to connect to the resilience of the human spirit. We need some balance. We need to not be so caught in expectation and demand. July 6th was the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday, and he was in LA, and someone had invited me and made it possible for me and many people, different people, to make a video wishing him a happy birthday. And so for my video, I told one of my favorite Dalai Lama stories, which was really all about compassion. And that is, we opened up the Insight Meditation Society building. You know, we bought the retreat center and opened it up in 1976. And in 1979, we heard that the Dalai Lama was coming to the area. Amherst, Massachusetts is about 45 minutes away. And at the time, Bob Thurman was a professor of Buddhist studies in Amherst before he moved to New York and Columbia. And he and the Dalai Lama were very close. And so he was bringing the Dalai Lama to Amherst. So we were very young, very naive. And we shot off a letter to the private office of the Dalai Lama. And we said, maybe he wants to come see us too. We're close by. And to our amazement, at one point, we got a letter back saying, yeah, he'll come. So then we had to get everything ready. And while security then was nothing like it is now, still it was a complete zoo for us. The center is about 2 miles outside of the town of Barrie on this little road called Pleasant Street. And we had to blockade Pleasant Street. And we had state troopers patrolling the roof with guns. And it was like this total zoo-y scene. And just a little bit before he was supposed to come, I'd been in a car accident and I had a broken bone in my foot and I was using crutches. So the day came that he was arriving and I was outside with like 100 other people standing way in the back and feeling very morose. I kept thinking, you know, I should be up front, really. I mean, I helped start this place, you know. But here I am, I'm like way in the back and stuck in the back, and it's so unfair, but I'm such a klutz, you know, I'm so bad with these crutches. If I was up front, I'd probably fall on my face in front of him. That'd be even worse, so I better stay in the back. Oh, but I'm in the back, and it's so terrible. I'm stuck in the back. I should be in the front. No, I can't be in the front. I better stay in the back. And then his car pulled up, and he got out, and he did something I've seen him do many times since, which is that he seems to have a radar, kind of radar, for who in a crowd might be suffering the most. And he goes there. And that was me. So he got out of the car. He cut through like 100 people. He came up to me. He took my hand. He looked me in the eye. And he said, what happened? And that was the moment that redefined compassion for me. Because I realized he could not make the car accident not have happened. He could not make the injury not have happened. He couldn't make me more skillful in the use of the crutches. But that horrible, terrible, corrosive feeling of being so alone, so unseen, so stuck in the back, it was gone. And that really, it's been the bedrock of my feeling about compassion ever since. So I got to make that video, which is online somewhere. YouTube, Facebook, find me on Twitter. I have several Twitter friends here. But it's such an enormous moment, right? You can't fix it sometimes or ever. But we can be there in a very different way with this very profound sense of connection. Then we don't burn out. It's very different. So it's a very powerful exploration. What is compassion? What could it possibly mean to have compassion for yourself and for someone else? What does it mean to have compassion for someone and know that it would be absolutely wrong to like give in and you're just not going to do that? What does it mean to have compassion for someone and realize I can't fix it? I'm going to do everything I can, and in the end, it's not in my hands. That's just not the way life is. You know, so it's very profound. It's not just like I feel bad for you, and I'm done. And then maybe the last thing I'll say before we move to questions is there's a big difference between having a genuine, powerful sense of compassion, which, remember, is a quality of generosity of the spirit. It's offering. It's caring. There's a big difference between that and having that inner state mandate a certain kind of action or response, which it actually doesn't. When we talk about action, certainly within, say, the Buddhist psychology, we talk about, first of all, the power of one's motive, one's intention. It's like if I reached down and picked up this striker, and I went to hand it to one of you as a gift, all anybody would see is my hand moving down, picking up an object, and moving it forward, right? But what's the motivation? What's the heart space in that offering? Maybe I'm offering it to you because I like you and I want you to have it. Maybe I'm offering it to you because I see you have this fantastic water bottle. And I think, well, hey, maybe I'll give you this and you'll give me that. I just taught a retreat at Cloud Mountain Retreat Center. And I used that example. And this woman held up her water bottle and it was fantastic. And I thought, wow, I want that water bottle. She didn't offer it to me. Or maybe I'm giving you this because I don't like you all that much. And I think, well, I'm not giving you the bell, am I? You know, you're going to go home and what are you going to do, waving around in the air? But it's like the same smile. It looks like exactly the same action on the surface. But it's only from knowing my own motive that I can tell the difference between this action and what looks completely identical on the surface, but might be coming from a totally different place. So that we use mindfulness to know our motive, to see where we're coming from. What do I really want out of this meeting, out of this conversation, out of this encounter? And it's also said that if we cultivate and strengthen qualities like loving kindness and compassion, then our field of motivation will change. If, for example, we've largely been coming from a place of fear in what we do or what we say, that fear will actually get replaced by a sense of connection. So it's not like you have to give yourself a lecture and you think, oh, damn, you know. I spent 5 days in a compassion retreat and, you know, I better act like. It's not like that. It shifts, our worldview shifts, our field of motivation shifts. Okay, so that's the first part of an action, is the intention or the motive. The second part of an action is the skillfulness or unskillfulness of the execution of the action. And this means mindfulness in a bigger way. Mindfulness of context means discernment, means learning from our mistakes. It means learning skills so that I sometimes call it our best guess of what's the most appropriate, skillful way to act or thing to say or way to say it in this given moment, in this time, in this context. And when we confuse those two, the motivation and the skillfulness of the action, that's when they morph together. That's where people get kind of squeamish. They think, ooh, you know, if I were to develop a loving heart, if I were to develop a compassionate heart, I could only say yes. I could only let them do it again. I could only give away all my money. But really, you might genuinely be coming from a deeply compassionate place, and your best guess of the most appropriate way to act in a certain situation at a certain time is pretty fierce. It's saying no. It's drawing a strong boundary. It's being kind of intense, actually. It doesn't mean you're coming from a bad place. It means that's your sense of the most appropriate way to be. And I think, you know, we always talk about this, and the reason is that it's very important to have those as distinct rather than as one, because to develop a compassionate heart doesn't mean that we're then consigned, you know, to this very narrow little range of responses that we can never vary from. Like, always saying yes, always being sweet, being kind of meek, giving it all away, letting them do it again. It's not like that. We know there's such a thing as tough love. We know there's such a thing as fierce compassion. And we have to look. We have to look really honestly, like, where am I coming from? What is my motive? And is there something I might have done differently? Maybe I didn't have to give this beautiful striker so publicly, bringing forth the envy of everyone else in the room. You know, maybe this was best done privately or whatever. Of course, we continue to learn. But those two aspects really need to be distinguished so that we can feel the tremendous possibility and potential and freedom of actually developing greater and greater compassion. Bless you. So do you have questions? Do you have comments? I don't know if we pass around a microphone or I just need you to talk loudly. I'm not really sure. And no one's about to tell me, so.
No, I think
I
would just ask the questions loudly.
Okay. Okay, so we don't have a wireless mic. Okay, thank you. You're the lady I needed. Yes.
Maybe if you could repeat.
Yeah, I'll repeat the question. Yeah.
My question is, could you talk a little bit about compassion with self? I feel like that's the biggest struggle I have.
Okay, so could I talk a little bit about compassion with oneself? Because for many people, that can be the biggest struggle. And in some ways, I mean, it's definitely an essential ingredient. And I wouldn't say that one has to develop it. From my point of view, it's not that you have to develop it perfectly before you can have compassion for others. But we can't forget ourselves completely because it'll never sustain. Whatever effort, whatever compassion we have for someone else will ultimately, and maybe not a long time from now, crumble. Because we need wherewithal. They say, like in the Buddhist tradition, if you go to a country like Burma, so I'm going to take this to material generosity for a moment because it's just more concrete. Many things are celebrated through generosity. So if it's like your birthday, you don't expect to get gifts, you expect to give gifts. So if it's your birthday, you go off to the monastery and you offer food for as many people as you can possibly afford to give food to. If someone in your family dies, you go off to the monastery to honor their memory. If your daughter's graduating from high school, you go to the monastery. So people are continually giving and offering, right? And of course, it's an extremely poor country. Certainly when I was there practicing, it was one of the poorest countries in the world, probably still is. And yet, everything we needed, we were given. Because there was something, and people would come and like watch us eat the food, and they were so happy at the chance to give. So even though by external measures, they had so little, they had something inside, some sense of sufficiency or abundance so that they felt able to offer. I was just telling this story in the retreat about how a meal in Burma in the monastery is very formal. There's like a formal processional, and you come in and you bow to the Buddha, and then you sit down, and there are all these little tables where you're, it's like family style, so there may be like 8 people around each table. And so I did all that, and I looked at the food, and I thought, that looks like matzo ball soup or something like that. and that looks like white fish salad. I thought, oh my God, this is like a Jewish meal. I'm hallucinating. I've been meditating too long. Like, and then I found out that there's a tiny little Jewish community in Rangoon, and somebody had died, and so the family had come to offer food and not only provide the money, but they provided the recipes. So it really was a Jewish meal. But anyway, you know, so to be in that kind of environment where people by external measure had so little, but there was such joy in giving, and then to come back to the States where so many people I knew had so much, but maybe not even the internal feeling of having enough ever. And so it was so much harder to offer, to give. So that lesson about generosity is taken to the realm of compassion, which is like generosity of the spirit. So if you feel like there is nothing going on inside, it's so hard. And therefore, it's not a selfish act. It's not being self-centered. It's not being indulgent to cultivate that sense of kindness towards yourself and resource, so that we recognize we do have something to give, every one of us. Presence, caring, attention, whatever it is, right? So self-compassion, which is kind of all the rage now in psychology in many ways, is also not easy to understand. I've heard a lot of, because of course, you know, I talk about it all the time, beginning again. You're with the breath, your mind wanders, you need to let go. If you judge yourself for the next day and a half, that day and a half is wasted, right? You really want to make progress, you have to let go and forgive yourself and begin again. With anything, what I say now in my senior status is nothing in life is a straight shot, right? We're always beginning again. We're falling down, getting up, going forward. We're making a mistake. We have to start over. We lose sight of our aspiration. We have to begin again. That's just the nature of life. And the most powerful, effective way to go on is through self-compassion. And a lot of people push back against that. You know, I've had people say, well, you know, if I make a mistake and I forgive myself, it's laziness. It's like saying, what's the difference? I'll make another mistake in 2 minutes. I'll forgive myself again. Who cares, you know? But it's not like that. I think when we really look at applying ourselves or really wanting to be excellent or get something done, it's not through judgment and harshness and punishing ourselves that those things aren't onward leading. I asked a scientist friend of mine, this was a year or two ago, if there were actual studies about self-compassion being a kind of better climate for accomplishment in some way. And at that time he said, no, he didn't know yet of any, but he said there are tons of performance studies of all kinds that show that a harsh, punitive environment will really spike your performance briefly, and then you crash, right? So if we're talking about a sustained effort toward anything, or getting good at something over time, or being able to hang in there in a complex, suffering situation, piling on ourselves is not actually going to help us. So even though maybe we've been taught, or maybe we just think that's being kind of lazy or indulgent, it's not. You know, to develop self-compassion is really a critical tool in accomplishing anything. So how do we do it? We do it lots of different ways. If you are practicing even the way we practiced before with the breath, given the undoubted reality that it's probably not going to be 800 or 900 breaths before your mind wanders. It's probably going to be like 2, you know, or 4, you know, maybe 5. Then we're gone. And then we realize it. we have to let go, and with compassion toward ourselves, begin again. That's a challenge, and that's the training. There's plenty of opportunity to have to let go and begin again, right? Whatever technique we're using, the essence of it is going to be letting go and beginning again, because that's just how it is. And every time we do that, we're like strengthening that muscle. Even if the word compassion or self-compassion is never ever spoken about, that will do it. We actually actively work to reframe things, like when you see your own jealousy or anger or greed coming up, rather than calling those qualities bad or wrong or terrible, which is what we tend to call them, we make an effort to reframe that. Oh, these aren't like bad states. These are states of suffering. These are states of pain. And see what happens from that, right? Actually doing like a loving kindness practice, which includes love and compassion for ourselves, is it's just a very powerful transformative tool. It works. It's maybe not working at the pace we would like it to work, but it works. And it's also very important, and it's hard for us. Like, when you talk about a practice like loving kindness meditation, which is its own methodology, the great temptation is to look at the formal period of our practice, like we did a retreat or we sit every day for 10 minutes or whatever. The great temptation is to look at that for signs of progress. But you may not find those signs there. You will find them in your life, which is where it counts, right? But most of us tend to long for the great breakthrough experience. We want to be able to say at 4:15, I love myself completely, you know, and it was like rainbows and balloons and stuff like that. More likely it's not going to be that way, but if you give it some time and you look at your life, you'll see you're different. We're different with ourselves when we make a mistake. We're different meeting a stranger. We're different when the airline loses our luggage. You know, we're different in all kinds of situations. And so the best spirit is probably saying, oh, I'm going to try it for this length of time, whatever you choose, and really try it for that length of time and then see. If it seems worth pursuing after that. And when you're trying to decide, look at your life to see if it's made any changes.
And I just wonder, taking in other people's vulnerability and showing their own vulnerability, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that's a strength.
Okay, so how is taking in others' vulnerability and showing your own vulnerability a strength? Well, I think in the way that it's, you know, currently used, which is quite a lot. I think it's really mostly a question of being honest, you know, being more truthful than we tend to be. One of the things that I like about intensive retreat as just an experience is that unless you happen to have dinner together the night it starts, which is the last time you speak, before the end of the retreat, you're so unlikely to have kind of the data file on everybody sitting around you. And one of the things I've found really interesting lately is how when we meet somebody, the first question pretty much is, what do you do? Not like, what makes you happy? What's your new challenge? What's your favorite color? It's like, what do you do? It's like, I need to slot you in somewhere. And in a retreat, that's irrelevant. You know, you have no idea. Unless you're both veggie washers in the kitchen or something, or, you know, mopping the dining room floor together. It's like, you have no idea what this person does. And so we relate to one another not through the social contract and the ordinary ways of being, but simply being together in a deeper fashion. And so I see it as something like that, you know, even though we're not silent and we are revealing, perhaps, depending on the situation, you know, something may be appropriate in one situation and not so much in another. But it's just like a more truthful way of being. So another example would be, as annoying as it can be and as formulaic as it can seem, when communications counselors suggest one uses I language, it actually implies a kind of honesty, right? And vulnerability, because it's one thing to say you're a horrible person and you never do the right thing, and it's another thing altogether to say, I was really hoping to be your friend and I was really disappointed when, instead of talking to me at all, you just chose to walk by me. You may not still get the answer of the friendship you're yearning for, but that's an honest statement, right? And you may, in some context, choose to be that revealing or not that revealing, but that's actually the truth of the experience. And the rage and the resentment is something happening in response to that. It also, you know, brings up the question of, do we actually want true communication? Because if we want true communication, it doesn't come from, you're a horrible person and you never pay attention to anybody other than yourself. It just doesn't. So we have to open some door, if that's what we actually want, that allows an authentic connection. And so that's really what it is. I mean, that's how I would tend to use the word. And when I said, you know, we are all vulnerable, we all share vulnerability, that was mostly in contrast to the kind of idea that I have it all together, you know, and you poor thing, you know, I feel so bad for you. Having that kind of disruption, that kind of uncertainty, that kind of impermanence in your life, which I never will, you know, and to realize it's just not true. Yes. So what's the most compassionate response, say, if you're approached by a homeless person who wants money or something from you without being enabling or disrespectful on the other side? Unfortunately, I don't actually think there's a formula. Like, this is the A1 compassionate response. Because remember, there are those two aspects. There's the motivation, which includes your worldview, like, how do I see that person? And then there's the action that you choose to take, which is based on discernment. which is very situational, you know, like right in that moment. I was teaching a loving kindness non-residential retreat in New York City once years ago. And so that meant all our, it was just in someone's apartment. And so all our walking meditation was out in the streets, right? And then we'd come back and sit and then we'd go out and walk. And so somebody on the retreat said to me when he came back in, somebody approached me for a dollar, and as is my habit, I gave him a dollar. But for the first time ever, I looked a homeless person in the eye and realized it was actually a human being. Now, I've also been in situations where I was walking down the street once in New York City and with a friend for whom her sobriety is extremely important. And we were approached by a homeless person who asked for money. And she said, I'm not going to give you money because I'm afraid you're going to use it to drink, but I will take you into that little grocery store and you can order anything you want to eat and I'll pay for it. So we went in there and it was kind of an amazing, beautiful, tender moment because, I mean, if you have a life like that, choice is not a big element of it. You know, I think I'll have the pizza with that topping rather than that topping. I mean, it just isn't. And she kind of opened that up for him, and he was so happy. It was really an extraordinary moment. That's another option. Or you say no, but not in that a way of sort of despising someone or discounting them. And, you know, so I wish there was a formula to say, oh, yeah, this is the compassionate tact. But that's why, you know, over and over again we talk about look at your motivation, look at your worldview. How are you, in a way, respecting the innate dignity of everybody? And then what's your discernment telling you in this particular moment in time? And that doesn't mean we never make a mistake. You know, maybe we have really partial information or whatever it is, but that's the only thing we've got, is our discernment, or it's like our mindfulness and our ability to keep learning and keep understanding things and situations more and more. And then there's also the possibility, which, you know, I know many people who do, which is to, for a period of time, like a discrete period of time, take on an exercise, right? So my friend Bob Thurman, for example, the way he described it was, I decided, I don't know, it was like a month or something like that. He said, I decided for this period of time, my yoga, meaning my discipline, was going to be to put a whole bunch of single dollars in my pocket. And when, from where he was living at that point, he said, when I walked to Columbia to teach, there's just like so many street people asking for money, and I'm just going to give each of them a dollar. And the whole time, I'm going to keep paying attention to my mind, my heart, what I'm feeling, what it's like, the connection, because ultimately we need that sort of awareness, right? So he said that he was doing it, and he was seeing all kinds of things. And then one day he reached into his pocket, and he handed someone what turned out to be a $20 bill, because he put it in his pocket by mistake. And he said, and I just stood there. And I thought, I can't take it back, you know? Like, what am I going to do? And he just, like, watched that, you know, whole realm. Or, you know, whatever your, it's like an experiment. I'm going to make an experiment in behaving in a certain way for this limited period of time. And I'm going to keep paying attention. You know, what am I learning in this process? And what's the stretch? What's the expansion? Which is another option, you know, if you choose to do that. Yeah.
I have a question about compassion in relation to like nebulous difficulty that happens in the world. It's one thing you have this compassion to make sure you're one on one with somebody, but how does compassion go to people, for instance, the shootings in South Carolina or something that you feel, but you're not necessarily having ever any contact with any of the people involved.
I mean, one of the things, I think it's a... Oh, the question was about... Did you hear that?
No.
Okay, so the question was about having compassion for sort of world events, not this person that's in front of you or that you know, but something like the shootings in South Carolina. Like, where's the... What's the role of compassion with something that is actually more nebulous? You know, we're not in this day-to-day confrontation. Like, I'm on my way to work and this happens. So, I mean, I think compassion, of course, needs to be really understood, that it's not like passivity. It's not just giving in. But I think the suffering, clearly, the suffering abounds in those situations. You know, I thought so often just then, like, what's it like to be 21 years old and so filled with hatred and taking an action that has now determined the entire rest of your life? And to have taken an action that has caused so much harm, you know, and so much devastation, like 21 years old. And so that's not the same as complacency, but it's like, whoa, look at that. And then to see that we participate in a culture that in so many ways supports hatred and separation. That's something to look at, you know? It's not only compassion, but I think it's a kind of training to look deeper, you know, look at causes and conditions. Because if we stay on the surface, we will never find resolution. We'll just stay on that same level of self and other and us and them. Look deeper. I remember when this Thai activist, Sulak Shiva Rockstra, whom I just saw in France, oddly enough, came to Barrie to IMS to visit. And he's a big Thai activist, social justice advocate. And he was just sitting in someone's house. We were chatting, you know, before we were going over the center. And he said, you know, if you want to try to solve the problem of the sex trade in Thailand, he said, look at agricultural policy. Look deeper. You know, why are those farmers so poor? Why are they starving? Why are they selling their children? And it always stayed with me, you know, like, if we stay on the surface, then we are looking for solutions that won't resolve anything in the end. But we need to be able to look deeper, and as deeply as we can in any situation. And I think compassion actually is a tool that allows us to do that, so that we don't get so overwhelmed completely all of the time. And that gives us a kind of strength to look more deeply, more completely, to the best of our ability at what's happening. And there are plenty of world events, you know, that are of that kind. So, and I think there's also a role, you know, it's not easy for the most part to sit with our own difficult feelings, whatever those might be. And in some way, we really need to be able to include everything we feel. I was teaching in Barrie very recently, and somebody in a question and answer session, she raised her hand and she said, I have a very, very hard time allowing myself to feel sadness. And she said, so I decided to give a dinner party for all my feelings, like all parts of myself. And a lot of it was around South Carolina, and her voice was shaking. And she said, and I invited my sadness to the dinner table. And we just hung out together. And you need a great deal of compassion for yourself. You know, you can't be freaking out. I shouldn't feel this. You know, why is this still here? I should be better than this. Whatever it is we tell ourselves. But it's like, okay, here we are. That doesn't mean you want certain dinner guests to take over the house, you know. In a vast oversimplification of this Tibetan Buddhist practice, they will say, invite all parts of yourselves, including your demons, to dinner. And I was once giving that instruction or that suggestion in the hall in Barrie. And somebody raised their hand and said, I don't like that. So I said, how about inviting them in for a cup of tea? You know, it's like you keep an eye on them. You don't let them take over. But you also don't have to be, like, so upset, you know. You can have some kindness toward yourself and, you know. So they didn't like that either. And then they said to me, how about a cup of tea to go? And I said, okay, cup of tea to go. You know, that works too. Hey, yeah. Why do people do awful things both to themselves and to others? Well, part of me says, I don't know, but part of me says, I think it's because of ignorance, you know? Like, we actually don't understand. Like, from the Buddhist teaching, they say everybody wants to be happy. Every single person wants to be happy. We all want, and not just superficial happiness, we want, like, a deep sense of connection and belonging and feeling right. And but we get tremendously confused about where to find that. And we get a lot of messages also that say, if I'm really nasty to other people, I'll feel strong. If I take revenge, I'll be invulnerable. If I get kind, I'll be weak. People rip me off. We get a lot of messages about where we're going to find our greatest strength and happiness, and many of them are not correct. So we need to be able to have a process of really looking and saying, well, you know what? I did that or I acted in that way. It didn't actually make me all that happy. Or look at this. I thought that kind of person was so different than me, and then I met them and they're not so different. You know, we have to have a different kind of attitude, I think, about investigating and really exploring our lives, because the possibility of very awful action is very strong. Okay. We're going to have to stop. I will see, I hope, many of you tomorrow. You had, I don't know, Tuwery may have another announcement. You had some announcements you wanted to make about tomorrow.
Yes.
Well, thank you all. It's really, it's lovely to be here.